You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, there have been 6 deaths and hundreds of lung illnesses being blamed on e-cigarettes, especially from bootleg products. We'll talk to a tobacco researcher about the potential dangers associated with vaping and what researchers can learn from decades of tobacco-related data. Now, picture this, a photo with the heads of Democratic candidates for president swapped in onto the bodies of characters from Harry Potter, draped in Hogwarts robes. Might get a chuckle from some people, not from others. Our next guest says viral products like this are popping up more and more around the internet, and it's just one sign of the way celebrity fan culture is finding its way into American political life. Amanda Hess is a critic for the New York Times, where she writes about internet culture, including a recent piece called United We Stand. Amanda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start with this concept of stan, because it's important to this piece you wrote. And for people who aren't immersed in internet culture, it is completely meaningless. Define it for us, the stan.
Yeah, okay. So the stan is basically an obsessive fan. And it's a term that came out of an Eminem song called Stan that was about a fan of his who was so obsessed with him that he basically ends up killing for Eminem. And so stan has been like reclaimed by people who love celebrities to the extent that like they will metaphorically, on Twitter at least, like kill for them.
Right. So they'll say, I stan Beyonce, for example, or other insert celebrity there.
Yeah. And now people are starting to say that about candidates that they support in the upcoming election, too.
Yeah, and that's the focus of a couple pieces you've written. We're taking reporting our madness for celebrities in some ways and taking it into the political world. Talk about how you've seen that happening.
You know, I think I really started to notice it in the run-up to the 2016 election. There was this meme that defined the primary that was called Bernie versus Hillary, and it took the form of like a fake civics education poster that was comparing Bernie and Hillary on the issues. Except in the meme, the issues would be like Nintendo games or wolves or Radiohead, and the gist of the meme was that Bernie could speak, you know, very authoritatively on all of these pop culture issues, whereas Hillary was trying to be cool but failing. And I found the meme to be so interesting because it was directly translating these candidates and their ideological divide into something else, like something very pop cultural, in a way that was not necessarily how the Bernie Sanders campaign might want to promote its candidate, in that, like, a lot of people found the meme to be sexist, and that was a problem for Bernie's campaign. And also, you know, Bernie Sanders is a candidate who really kind of rejects talking about pop culture. He wants to talk specifically about the things that animate him and that he wants to change about the country. And so I was fascinated by the fact that his fans were doing this thing that he probably wouldn't sanction himself and that his campaign certainly wouldn't do.
And that was one example. And you've seen it snowball since then in different ways for different political figures, candidates, and others. Talk about how that's exploded since then.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you are on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram, or Reddit, you see politics discussed in a way that feels more like it's a pop cultural product. And sometimes that's very literal in the case of, you know, actually photoshopping Elizabeth Warren's face onto Hermione's body from Harry Potter. And sometimes it's a little bit less literal. But it's just become this very powerful way of experiencing politics and something that was just not possible before all of these crowdsourced platforms arose.
This is a lot about the internet, but it's not just about the internet. You also mentioned the people who tour Donald Trump rallies. They will travel the country for the sole purpose of participating in this event, as though like people might have followed the Grateful Dead back in the day.
Yeah, and I think especially Donald Trump is a very interesting example of this, because for years and years, before any of these platforms existed, before he ever had any real presidential aspirations, there were people who were kind of like joking about inserting him into the political conversation. So Spy Magazine, which is this satirical magazine that took Donald Trump as one of its like greatest enemies, joked in 1988 that he should run for president. And that was something that to me seemed like a real precursor of a lot of what you see now, and that they were taking this, you know, in this case, it was the opposite. They were taking a pop culture figure and putting him into politics. But so it's something that has existed before, but that's really been, I think, blown up by the internet.
Talking to Amanda Hess from The New York Times, looking at the ways that celebrity culture and fan culture has moved into the political world. And in some ways, you touched on this in one of your pieces, Donald Trump has been doing the attention economy before we called it the attention economy. He was obsessed, I think it's fair to say, like him or not, and really good at creating a brand around himself, just the way that millennials and Generation Z is being coached to for their careers now.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things about the attention economy is this idea that whether you're getting good attention or bad attention, all attention is good. And that's something that I think Donald Trump has always understood. He's always been this controversial figure who sort of drew attention to himself, not necessarily by doing things that were reflected positively on him. And that's so interesting to me because I think the presidency, above all, you know, like if you could assume anything about running for president, it's that you would want people to like you, to like have a positive, to have positive attention on you if you wanted to convince people to elect you. And now I think Donald Trump has really kind of upended that because he has so embraced negative attention and really sort of presented himself as a heel in a way that seems very, very internet savvy, but he was doing all along.
What's the Oscar Wilde quote? The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about. That seems pretty perfect for internet culture.
Yeah, I mean, I think for sure it is.
Now, looking at the ways people are using this crop of Democratic candidates as their fan obsessions, what do you see? Who's benefiting from this and who is not?
I mean, I think that Andrew Yang is the candidate who gets the most attention for turning basically a zero profile into, you know, someone who is standing there on the debate stage where all of these people, you know, like Kirsten Gillibrand, a United States senator, could not make it to where he is. And a lot of that has to do with just like the sheer online energy around him and the branding that has come up really organically from his fans. But at this point, you see it with everyone. The person who I think to me is the most interesting center of that content right now is Elizabeth Warren, because she is being branded online in this way that's very similar to the way that Hillary Clinton's fans sort of created fan fiction and memes around her. But Elizabeth Warren is a very, very different candidate than Hillary was. And so when you see both women as stand-ins for Hermione from Harry Potter, you really collapse the like political distinction between them in a way that I think is not necessarily great for Elizabeth Warren's pitch to America, because Hillary lost, right? So she probably doesn't really want to compare herself too much to her, but that her fans, you know, very enthusiastically are doing anyway.
We're talking to Amanda Hess, critic and internet culture writer at The New York Times, looking at the ways fan culture, the way people, you might expect them to follow celebrities, musicians, actors, whatever, it's really going into American politics, she writes, and the way we talk about, think about, tweet about candidates. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you created or circulated memes about your favorite or one of your favorite political candidates or political figures? Are you someone's political fan? Do you see people doing this online or maybe even in person? Do you see an upside, downside, a little bit of both? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we pick up our talk with Amanda Hess, New York Times critic. She writes about internet culture, and in two recent pieces, she looks at the ways that the kind of fan culture we see around celebrities has found its way into politics, mostly online, a little bit offline, too. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think this kind of fan culture going into the political world is a good thing? It gets people more engaged, or it's a bad thing? It kind of trivializes stuff. What do we stand to gain or lose as a democracy here? And do you share memes? Do you look at memes online about politicians, candidates, other political figures? Have you made one? Or do you think they're silly or funny? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll bring on a caller. Dave is with us in Milwaukee. Dave, hi.
Good afternoon, folks. This is a really great topic. It's 420. So I guess my comment is, it seems like these Trump people come up with these little nasty memes all the time. For instance, when Elizabeth Warren was a professor of color at Harvard, because of her Native American descent, the Trump supporters come up with all these little memes talking about, you know, rude stuff about First Nations people and all that. And I just think it's really rude, and we need to find a way to ban it or get it deplatformed or take it off, like shut down that internet, because it seems like these people are really expressing themselves rudely about a Native American.
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Controversy, of course, over Senator Warren's origins. But the Trump supporters, Amanda, and the memes that we've seen surrounding Donald Trump, what have we seen?
Well, first, I guess I would just say that we're not going to be able to unplug the internet, whether that's for better or for worse. But yeah, Donald Trump's fans, and I think this is really a feature of all of these fandoms, are also creating, you know, like anti-memes about other candidates. And that can be just as powerful, I think, as boosting your own candidate, you know, creating images that are meant to defame or tear down someone else, I think, have become really, really powerful.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Amanda, you point toward a double-edged sword. If when people are treating politicians and like talking about them in terms of whatever, Harry Potter or Game of Thrones or Handmaid's Tale, in one sense, you see it could get more people involved and actively engaged in politics. In another sense, by looking at it in these fictional terms, it might make people feel more distant from political realities. How do you try to sort that out?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the fundamental paradox of the whole thing. It can be, I think, so engaging to people to be able to experience politics this way. It's a way of making it more democratic in a way, in that, you know, people who maybe never saw themselves as being interested in having political discussions can find, you know, a point of connection with candidates in this way. And I think that's wonderful. But at the same time, I think that can be a little bit of an illusion, that we don't necessarily have more power over the political process just because we have the power to Photoshop someone into our favorite, you know, movie series.
Another weird gulf that's out there is a substantial portion of the U.S. population who's very active on Twitter, who might see this sort of thing pop up on Facebook and elsewhere. Then there's a good chunk of people who are totally cut off from that. Which sometimes doesn't sound like such a bad thing. And so in some ways, people are living in two different worlds with this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think my grandfather, who's in Wisconsin and listening right now, probably is not experiencing politics in this way. I do think there's a way in which all of our media ecosystems, like, are in conversation with each other. So even if people are not necessarily seeing, you know, a meme about Elizabeth Warren on Twitter, the fandom around her and the way that her persona is pitched online, I think, can feed into how she's portrayed on cable television, for example. So I do think there's a relationship, even if people maybe don't see it directly.
Well, and among those people who are often on Twitter, I think journalists are probably very disproportionately represented, right?
That's very true. I do think Facebook still, and especially for people who are a little bit older, is a really powerful way that people are experiencing politics. So it's not just Twitter, even though I mean, I'll be the first to admit that I check it too much. So.
Talking to Amanda Hess, a critic for the New York Times. She writes about internet culture, and she's written a couple lengthy pieces about the ways that fan culture, the way people might treat or define themselves as fans of a pop culture artist, say a musician or an actor, is finding its way more and more into the political world, especially online, creating memes that portray a candidate sympathetically or unsympathetically, but using ideas from pop culture as well. Amanda, another worry that you have about this, and you touched on this a little bit earlier, is that our online representation, our fan representation of a candidate might start to move more and more away from what they actually stand for.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that I find the most interesting about this. So, for instance, Elizabeth Warren, there is a meme about her on Twitter that's really just like short form fan fiction about her. And it's her fans putting her into different scenarios and imagining how she would act. So, Elizabeth Warren always replaces the toilet paper roll after she finishes the last one or whatever. And the point of the meme is that she's a very decent person and a polite and nice person. And it's certainly supposed to be, you know, a positive meme in support of her. But at the same time, it really obscures the fact that her ideas are not about being a kind of decent person. They're about creating this like radical change in society. And that aspect of her pitch doesn't come through. And instead, it's just totally obscured by her personality. And so maybe that's a positive thing for Elizabeth Warren if it gets some people to say, oh, she seems really nice and I want to vote for a nice person. But I do think it does us a little bit of a disservice in that we're not talking about the issues when we're talking about, you know, what Elizabeth Warren would do in the supermarket checkout line.
Let's bring out another caller now. Stephen is with us in Madison. Stephen, hi.
Hi. You hit it right on the head. You got my question. My question was, you know, we're talking about fandom. What that is cult of personality. And I don't think cult of personality is good for politics. My question was going to be, whatever happened to talking about policy and whatever happened to talking about issues? I don't care how cool a candidate is. And I'm 33 years old and I don't have Facebook or Twitter or anything like that. And I think that demographic is very underrepresentative because nobody hears about us. But we do go vote.
Stephen, thanks a lot for the call. I can't remember if you actually used the phrase cult of personality in your piece, Amanda, but that was, if you didn't use the phrase, the idea was there. Okay,
I did. Yeah. You're my hero for not being on Facebook or Twitter. And I think especially, you know, for people on the left, there are people who looked at the election of Donald Trump and they said, wow, this is a very scary cult of personality that's been built up around this person. And instead of rejecting that, I think people who are hoping to defeat Donald Trump this time around are building cults of personality around their preferred candidates. And maybe that is the, you know, strategically like a good way to try to win. But I think in the long run, it really distances us from what we should be talking about, which is like what we want for our country.
Stephen, thanks a lot for the call. That reminds me, back in the 2000 elections, there was the question, and this came from the media, but like, who would you rather have a beer with, George W. Bush or Al Gore? Mm-hmm. Have we changed that much? We've all often had these sort of personalized approaches to candidates.
Yeah. In 2016, Doris Kearns Goodwin, the historian, made the point that like it hasn't always been about personality. So at some point, candidates were really representatives of their party and people were voting on party platforms. And it was a lot less about the personality of the candidate. That, you know, has not been the case, I think, for a long time. They've been pop culture figures for a long time. The thing that I think has changed is our relationship to that. So instead of, you know, just passively watching these people as sort of pop culture figures on television, we are actively involved in creating these personas around them. So it's not just the campaigns that are making them. It's not just the media that's making the persona. It's us. And that really involves us so much more in this whole scenario. And so it becomes, you know, a real question for all of us. Like, is this what we should be doing?
Stephen, thanks a lot for your call. Amanda, another concern, and this might be the most fundamental concern you bring up, is the idea that if we share a meme or create a meme or have a funny thing about a pop culture reference to our political candidates, we feel like we're being politically active and maybe we're really not. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think social media in general seems like a very democratic form in that everyone has a voice. Everybody can post what they like on Twitter. But I think that can be a deceptive feeling, especially when it comes to literal democracy, because we may feel like we have the power to sort of build these candidates ourselves. But in the long run, what we're doing is, again, creating these cults of personality around them that make them actually less accountable to us. Because the way that a fan treats a star is it's a mode of adulation. And I don't think that's the correct posture for us to have for our political representatives. I think what I say in the piece is that this fan culture has us working for candidates when really the candidates should be working for us.
It's a good place to leave it. Amanda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Amanda Hess from the New York Times. She joins us for a look at fan culture in American politics. There are two big pieces on this she wrote over at the New York Times website. And you can share your thoughts over at Twitter. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up, alarms have been raised over the dangers of vaping after six people reportedly died from using e-cigarettes, likely bootleg products. How does this stack up against the ongoing dangers of old-fashioned tobacco use? A Wisconsin tobacco researcher joins the show. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, high-profile cases are drawing attention to potentially fraudulent practices at fertility clinics around the country. Find out what's happening tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, so far this year, there have been six confirmed deaths and roughly 380 confirmed cases of lung illnesses associated with vaping, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Many of the illnesses appear to be linked to bootleg vaping products, many containing THC. E-cigarettes use flavored liquid cartridges and a battery to create steam instead of traditional cigarettes. They've been popular among adults and even teenagers. The deaths and illnesses associated with vaping raised alarms for the general public, but how big of a threat is it compared to average tobacco usage? Our next guest joins us to talk about ongoing research into tobacco use and how vaping fits into the field. Dr. Michael Fiore is the director of the University of Wisconsin Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. Dr. Fiore, welcome back to Central Time.
Happy to be back.
Well, you've been following tobacco and smoking-related issues for a long time. What do you make of these acute illnesses and even deaths related, apparently, to e-cigarette use?
Well, first of all, we need to take the report seriously, and I look forward to chatting with you about it. I want to start, though, by emphasizing that, as you mentioned just a few moments ago, here's what we can't lose sight of. In Wisconsin today, 19 individuals will die of a disease directly caused by smoking cigarettes. This year in Wisconsin, 7,000 of our residents will be killed. Nationwide, 500,000 Americans will be killed from smoking. So we need to, as you said, recognize this potential new risk related with bootlegged vaping products. but we can't lose sight of what is the leading preventable cause of illness and death in our state and nationwide, and that is cigarette smoking and the lighting of tobacco, which generates 7,000 separate chemicals, 50 of which are carcinogens, and it's because of that that day in and day out, I see individuals and their families who are struck down by tobacco use.
Right. And why we in the media, I'll say, have paid a lot of attention to this vaping, this bootleg vaping and illness story. Is it because it's something that's newer? It's a newer technology. And the those deaths you mentioned, the regular death toll from regular tobacco has just kind of faded in, as background noise for us?
Well, that's one of my concerns and why I need to highlight it, as well as the fact that, you know, one really tragic outcome of this is if someone who is an adult who has successfully quit smoking using not bootlegged vaping products, but commercial vaping products, which while not safe, appear to be safer than cigarettes, that if someone would turn from using those products back to smoking, it would really be a tragedy. But that you know, with all that said, we need to take the report seriously. And I think the way to do that might be as simple as this. Think about it as it relates to kids, and think about it as it relates to adults. Let's talk about kids. No kid should use any tobacco product, including any e-cigarette product. Pure and simple, don't use it. And it's not just because of the potential that the product is bootlegged, but rather because we know that if an adolescent is exposed to nicotine in any form, it permanently changes his or her brain and puts them at higher risk for progressing up to using cigarettes. So we want none of the kids in Wisconsin or nationwide to be using e-cigarettes, smokeless tobacco products, or regular cigarettes. They're deadly, and we don't want them to be using it. That's different, though, than the message we give to adults, which is that you need to take these reports seriously. But at least at this early point, when all of the evidence is not complete, it appears that much of the risk has been from bootleg products, including some of those potentially who came from Bristol, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Where we've seen that was one of the sites that potentially these bootleg products were being produced.
Is it hard to sell a public health message when you've got kind of two different angles, as you're just saying? If you're a young person, e-cigarettes, don't start vaping. Don't do it at all. If you're a current adult pack-a-day smoker, probably you're better off vaping than smoking. Does it get tricky to sort that out for the public?
Without a question, and I think a lot of that nuance has been lost, but here's a really important message for adult smokers in our state. We have a variety of approved treatments to help you to quit. For example, anyone in our state can call the number 1-800-QUIT-NOW for free counseling support, as well as a two-week supply of FDA-approved nicotine medicine mailed to your home, nicotine patches, gum, or lozenge. We also have at www.smokefree.gov the National Cancer Institute's web-based program to help you to quit. It's a text program, and a lot of people have found it incredibly useful. And finally, there are 7 medications that have been approved by the FDA as safe and effective to help people quit smoking. Medicines that you use typically for anywhere from 2 to 6 months as a bridge from deadly cigarettes to using medicine to using neither. And we know that those products are available. You can get them either over the counter or through your doctor. It's a great time to quit. So for all of those people out in Wisconsin who are addicted to cigarettes, the bulk of the people in our state, you have options apart from e-cigarettes or particularly bootlegging cigarettes to help you to quit.
Talking to Dr. Michael Fiore, director of the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention, talking about long-term smoking trends and health impacts and what to make of the latest news when it comes to e-cigarettes and vaping. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I had about a 20-year addiction to tobacco, and what struck me as most difficult was that when the gum came out, I tried to use the gum to quit and found that I had only switched myself from one addiction to another one. It took taking bupropion for 2 months to stop my nicotine addiction. The question I have is for the vaping, if they were really serious about using it as an alternative to nicotine with the idea of quitting, why are they adding good flavors to it? Why make bubblegum vaping? Because doesn't that seem to be defeating the whole point? And shouldn't we be concentrating on other things than a nicotine replacement as a means to quit nicotine addiction?
Charlie, thank you very much. Thanks a lot for the call. Congratulations on quitting yourself. Dr. Fiore, let's start with the flavored e-cigarette products, coming back to an argument that people used to be having over flavored cigarettes, for that matter.
Yeah. Well, Charlie, I just want to also commend you for quitting and sticking with it. So here's what we know. If you light a cigarette and take a puff of that cigarette smoke, you're ingesting into your lungs and ultimately into your body more than 7,000 different chemicals. And 50 of those chemicals cause cancer, benzene, for example. It also includes carbon monoxide, which is incredibly deadly in high levels. So when a person uses a nicotine medicine like the nicotine gum that Charlie used, the idea there is to go from 7,000 chemicals to one. The one, unfortunately, is addictive, but it is not one that causes heart attacks or strokes or COPD or cancer. The goal with these medicines is not to take them for the rest of your life, but to use them for ideally a small amount of time to serve as a bridge from deadly cigarettes to neither. But if, in fact, you have to use a little bit of nicotine for the rest of your life even, it's not the goal, but it's much safer than lighting a cigarette or two or a pack a day. Because it's a single medicinal product. Now, about flavors, when I see flavors like mango and bubblegum and the rest of them, what that says to me is that they're appealing to young people, and it's frankly despicable that the companies that are producing these products are producing them in a way that appears to be appealing to young people, because, again, there's a different set of messages for young people. No e-cigarettes, no regular cigarettes, no smokeless tobacco products. Pure and simple, we don't want to expose adolescent brains to these products. For many people who are adults, using a flavorant like menthol or mint, if they choose to use e-cigarettes to quit, is similar to the flavors they get from cigarettes and helps them to transition. With that says, we don't have compelling evidence yet that e-cigarettes help adults to quit. There's some suggestive evidence, but not conclusive evidence. So I'm with you, Charlie. I don't think we should have any flavorants in any of these products, regular cigarettes or e-cigarettes, because the ultimate goal here in Wisconsin and across the nation is a simple one. Let's get all tobacco out of our lives.
Talking to Dr. Michael Fiore right now, director of the University of Wisconsin Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. He's with us to talk about ongoing research into tobacco uses and to vaping and e-cigarettes as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234. 1234. Call in with your questions for Dr. Fiore, maybe your own experiences quitting smoking, using e-cigarettes. Are you worried about what you're seeing in the news about health risks of what appear to be predominantly bootleg e-cigarette products? If you're a parent, what do you tell your kid, your teenager, when it comes to tobacco and e-cigarettes? Call 800-642-1234. If you're a teen, love to hear from you. What are you seeing maybe at the new school year? 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about some illnesses and deaths related to vaping and how it fits into broader research into tobacco usage. Our guest says don't lose sight of the continuing health damage caused by smoking of old-fashioned tobacco products, cigarettes, cigars, and more. Dr. Michael Fiore is with us, director of the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your thoughts, maybe your experiences trying to quit, successfully quitting, still working on it. 800-642-1234. We'll bring on another caller now. Amanda joins us. Amanda, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Amanda?
So I have a few friends in college who I know have used bootleg THC cartridges. And the thing is that because marijuana isn't decriminalized in Wisconsin, people who know things and have information on these bootleg products are not going to come forward because that jeopardizes their own security and they could possibly get in trouble. I think that right now, if marijuana was decriminalized, we would have a lot more people coming forward and talking about what's going on and how these products are being made. But because it's not decriminalized, it's just not going to happen.
Amanda, thanks for the call. Dr. Fiore, you mentioned that operation in Bristol, Wisconsin. They were selling these bootleg THC vaping cartridges, and that seems like a big part of this story.
Without a question, among the 300 or so reported illnesses, the acute lung injuries that we've seen with these e-cigarettes, many of them, not 100%, but many of them, more than 80%, are associated with bootleg products. And remember, an electronic delivery device is a mechanism to heat up products so that they can be ingested into the lung. And that's important to know because it's not just tobacco that's put in these products, but other chemicals, other illicit drugs, and in particular, marijuana products. And many of the products that we've seen used have been THC and marijuana-related additives rather than the sorts of things that you would buy in a store. You're right, Amanda, that it's possible, at least, that even among those that weren't associated with THC use, that many of these young people may have used such products and don't want to report it because it would have legal implications for them. Here's the key message, though, for everyone. Don't buy anything off the street and ingest it into your lungs. We do know that some people have been very seriously damaged. It makes no sense. Stay away from it. Protect your lungs. We only have two of them. And once they're gone for good.
Thanks a lot for that call, Amanda. We'll go now to Rollin in Adams. Rollin, hi.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to bring it to the table that we're having two very separate conversations in what vaping and regulations and why adults put flavoring into their vaporizers. And then at the same time, the stories that we hear that bring us to the table now is that people are getting sick and hurt from it. And in my experience, every time I've seen a news story of anyone getting hospitalized or hurt from it, it generally leads towards the THC and the marijuana distillate aspect. I don't see much crossover from the actual nicotine vaping. And this is something that I'm concerned about just because I spent 4 years managing a vapor shop. And so I've got a really good insight as to how and why people use a vaporizer to then quit smoking, why they use bubble gum and cotton candy, why they use peppermint. So I see two different conversations, and I just want to try to see if we can connect to these.
Roland, thanks for the call. And yeah, it's been a little tricky, Dr. Fury, to sort out a few different threads here.
Yeah. Well, Roland, I just want to thank you for calling. As an individual who has managed a vape shop, you have an incredible amount of personal experience, and you bring to the table some of the really nuance of this challenge. So, again, what's the message that we should give everyone in Wisconsin? Don't buy products off the street that are at risk of damaging your lungs. That, in particular, there is recommendations not to use any of these products with additives like THC, like marijuana, like some of the other compounds that have been found in them. Pure and simple, don't use it. It is, as Roland says, a totally different ball game for adult chronic cigarette smokers who are trying to quit. As a physician who works to help people quit and have done that for my entire professional life, I turn people in the direction of treatments that I know have been approved as safe and effective by the FDA. There are 7 medications that fall under that category. We also have recommended by the Public Health Service calling the Wisconsin Tobacco Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW and accessing www.smokefree.gov for the National Cancer Institute support. Those are resources that can be highly effective for every smoker, and I would urge smokers in Wisconsin to look at them first.
Thanks for that call. Time for one more caller. Dan is with us in Altoona. Dan, hi.
Hi, yes. I'm a superintendent for the school district of Altoona, and I just want to say thank you very much for bringing some of this research to light here as schools all over the state and certainly in West Central Wisconsin look to really adapt to this as we're starting to see this become increasingly prevalent in students most dramatically in the last 3 years. One of the things that we notice most that is critical is the behavior effects that happen. Not so much that the nicotine is modifying the behavior, but that the addiction is so strong that it causes irritability and a need to have that drug in that moment, which causes students to be irrational at times and make some silly mistakes along the way. So I think sometimes that's an oversight. We think so much about the addictive qualities and what that could lead to into adulthood, but it's got a profound impact on the education and then therefore behavior as well. So thank you very much.
Dan, thanks so much for the call. Dr. Fury, just a minute or so left.
Yeah, real quick comment. First, Dan, thank you so much for calling, representing what's happening in schools. 20% of high school seniors report they've used e-cigarettes in the last month, most of them using a product called Juul. Many of them are addicted. They're reaching out for help. You can go online to something called the Truth Initiative, T-R-U-T-H Initiative, and they have a text program for adolescents to help them quit Juul and other e-cigarette devices. This is a growing problem among young people, and as said at the beginning, with kids, you should be using no tobacco products, whether it be e-cigarettes, regular cigarettes, or smokeless. Take advantage of the resources out there, and the Truth Initiative, a nonprofit, is one excellent one.
Thanks so much for that call. And just a quick reminder, Dr. Fury, the quit line is 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Is that right?
That is correct. And other resources for adults, smokefree.gov, and then the Truth Initiative is the third for adolescents.
Thanks so much for joining us today. That's Dr. Michael Fiore, director of the University of Wisconsin Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. He joins us today to talk about smoking trends around the country, as well as incidents involving vaping and bootleg products and what researchers are learning from ongoing studies of tobacco use. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll get the latest news in national politics from a subpoena of the president's tax records to the U.S. reaction to drone attacks on Saudi oil facilities. And we'll meet a Wisconsin photographer whose picture was selected as one of the best NFL photos of all time. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, spice up your morning with some great cooking advice on how to make the best use of your spice rack. And call in and share your favorite flavors. That's tomorrow at 6 on the morning show. Coming up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we're nearing the end of the decade, so we'll look back at the 2010s in music. We'll talk about the influence of hip-hop, the dominance of women on the charts, and a little bit of Old Town Road. You can join in right now over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know what new music you are tuned into. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.